This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 226 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, 2 weeks after US government employees return to work, we'll ask what lessons can be learnt from the 16-day shutdown and talk to a man who believes that Republican extremists present a real threat to the American political system.
Also ahead, as Britain prepares to celebrate Guy Fawkes Night, we'll light the fuse and stand well back as we explore the international history of fireworks with author and academic Simon Werrett.
And we'll meet Dutch writer and filmmaker Arnold van Bruggen, who has spent more time in Sochi than you might care to imagine. Arnold will join us in the studio to tell us some of the real stories of Russia's new Olympic region.
That's all to come, plus Tom Edwards with next week's news look ahead, and we'll be playing some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, there we are. We got through it, Andrew. We did it. How are you feeling? How are you feeling today?
I feel
we're propping each other up slightly.
Weak at the knees.
Weak at the knees.
We've just.
Well, that meant something else.
We've just completed the biggest ever issue of Monocle.
How many pages is it?
It's 400 and something, which is a lot more than the kind of 170s we started at.
Presumably our distribution model will be different. It'll be back to the 1950s. A man in a car will be driving around the world or the United States, wherever, selling it like a series of encyclopedias.
I think you do have to do a little bit of a workout before you pick it up. Actually, it's kind of, you know, they do those kind of get fit at Christmas kind of issues.
Yeah.
You just buy that issue and kind of like haul it around your kind of house a few times.
Exactly. And then you're done. Exactly. Put it in a tote bag, sling it over your shoulder. And then just don't walk up the escalator on the tube, for example, rather than standing, and you're done, right?
Exactly.
You can eat turkey with impunity.
You could kill the turkey with it, or you could just bang it over the head with the new monocle.
So it's been emotional, we could say. It's been a process that's nice to get to the end of, but also quite a handsome piece of kit in the end as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and it also includes the soft power survey we do every year now. It's got the Monocle 100, which are things to kind of make your life a bit better in 2014, and it's also got the travel top 50. Count them. That's a lot of things.
Read them and weep, you might almost say. And other than that, it's also been quite a nice bit of decompression in the evenings, lots of bits and pops to go to, cracking open a few beers and bottles of wine in the office. That sort of helps the... We don't want to let light in upon magic of the editorial process, but that's one of the ways you can sort of get through the week. Right? It's all right.
It's the only way I can keep you in the office. No, we did have some drinks for 2 years.
We did, didn't we?
Monocle 24. And we had the London, another London kind of like a book launch at Daunt's around the corner from here for the Monocle Guide to Better Living, which also involved a couple of glasses of wine.
So there's a quiet manifesto and then quite a loud one, depending upon what day and what we were drinking.
You leave my quiet manifesto speech alone.
We're 226 down, Andrew. It's been going well. It's nice to be sort of back in the studio doing it. But what we've got to do is we've got to revert to normal form, because do you know who's up next with his news look ahead?
It's little Tommy Edwards.
And now, from London, Camden's king of current affairs, the man who put the eek into Monocle Weekly, the ooh into the news. He once wrestled an angry mongoose. He doesn't sleep. He waits. He's about to open a can of whoop-ass on your week. And it's not even Monday. Undefeated, unflappable, and pretty much unheard of outside of digital radio, it's Monocle 24's news editor, Mr. Tom Edwards.
I think we think we may have to make a new one for next week.
I would like a new one. I do like that sort of slightly grandstand one.
Yeah,
it has a kind of late 70s quality, which some people may argue is entirely opposite. But let's see if we can change it up a few gears.
When would you like to have been born?
I don't know. I think maybe in some kind of Regency period.
Really? I can see. Are you? Is there a dandy in there waiting to get out?
I think so. I'd like to. Can we get Georgian on it?
Get Georgian on here.
I think that's what we need. I like seeing a silk breech and a stockinged foot. Stockinged
Why not?
Leg.
That sounds attractive to me.
Okay.
Queen Anne leg never goes amiss.
What's going to happen next week, Tom?
Okay, well, I've got a nice mix of light and shade, Rob. I know
last week's
like.
One was brilliant.
Oh well, this is
how can we? Where would we go? Never
live up Maybe to that, we should just it? Run that one again.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with this. Let's start with something. This is fairly serious. Start with serious, and then we'll work our way up to a bit more levity later. India and China. Joint military exercises. Now, I always find this quite interesting. Neighbouring nations, they get together, they trade information, they trade skills. This strikes me as rather interesting, particularly there's land troop operations, and everyone's heading to Chengdu in China. Mm. In particular, India's sending troops from its Sikh Light Infantry Battalion, who have a fearsome warlike reputation, of course. And I think it's quite interesting when we look at the region and there's shifting power and there's all this paranoia about who owns what in the sort of the Eastern Oceans and fears about Chinese dominance. Interesting that they're sort of hand in glove with a neighbour that perhaps we wouldn't anticipate as a potential military force.
Especially because they often have a bit of a kerfuffle going on up in the Himalayas as well.
Absolutely.
Between the two of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're not always the best of friends as it is. So I think it's really, really intriguing. And it's interesting to see the sort of new diplomatic relationship, new military relationships, and how they delicately change the balance of the region.
Well, I hope the Sikh battalion gets some time off, because don't worry, you look scared then that I was going to make some Sikh joke. I'm not going to make a Sikh joke.
Sikh and destroy.
No.
There it was.
Turban warfare.
That's good.
Turban warfare.
Shall we mention again your show, One Call 24, Andrew, The Turbanist, for the headwear fancying radio listener.
Yeah, we should do a kind of special from Amritsar. That would be very good. I was going to say that Chengdu, home of the panda.
Well, oh, I hope they're donning. Do they have hard hats
or the pandas?
Flak jackets? Little flak jackets. Pop them on.
You might not notice because it could. I hope they're going to be okay in the bamboo.
Exactly. Well, that's not that robust.
That's
is it?
Where that's Chengdu. They promote themselves as the home of the panda.
Yeah. I thought military training exercises were what you see secretaries doing in Hyde Park. You know, when you get run around and they make you wear like some bricks.
I think
say
when you're there in some shrubbery looking through field glasses. That's what I always see.
Okay, so that was your serious one.
Let's move on. Well, no, actually, I've got more. I've got another serious one, in fact. But this is kind of interesting. Let's come back to Europe. On Wednesday, we'll resume talks about potential Turkish accession into the European Union. And I think this is very interesting from a sort of geopolitical point of view, diplomatic point of view, not just what some of the big players within the EU make of this and what obviously the position that Turkey has, what their objectives are. Very interesting. It's obviously been curtailed. There's been a lot of delays because of well-documented problems within Turkey in terms of how they're managing their democratic development or not, as some people have suggested. But according to some of the key, you know, players in throughout Europe, in Berlin in particular, you've got the German deputy foreign minister who's supporting this move with more talk, saying Turkey's improved in many areas across the board, despite the problems they've had with using force to meet some of the dissent that we've seen recently. But I think those talks will be very interesting because obviously the whole makeup of the EU is such a hot potato. Post-2008, there's all these responsibilities that the big hitters have. And it's intriguing to me that Germany still seems very ready to continue to sort of extend the welcome ever, ever wider as the EU develops.
But it's not going to happen, is it?
What can they talk about? You know, can they make any impression? Because I think it's not just cynics like you, Andrew, but I think just, you know, people, seasoned observers will say this cannot work. With the present structures.
Turkey, they'd get my vote, but I think there are just too many countries who are opposed to them actually joining. And I think they feel that the eastern flank has gone far enough, as it were.
Well, yeah, but then a lot of people, even though cynics, think that, you know, a European Turkey needs Europe, Europe needs Turkey, and that to formalise that relationship will make the progress that otherwise couldn't happen. It's a debate that I don't think will end quickly.
The EU's been a bit of a membership tease, I think.
That's exactly right.
Showing a bit of ankle, but then not putting out at the end of the day.
Queen Anne leg.
It's Queen Anne leg again. Been another queen or king, I'm not sure who it would be. Shall I bring you the levity?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I'm a fan of, you know, tests for the intellect.
Okay.
Even if they take a sort of sporting...
Oh, you're not going to test us, are you?
No, don't worry. But I wondered whether you're fans...
How's your Sudoku, Andrew?
I like it with rice.
Shall you tell him, Rob, or should I? Okay. But what about chess? Old school test of intelligence, lateral thinking.
Yeah. I don't know.
Strategy.
Chess.
Do you really not?
No.
That's a crying shame. And you may not find this item particularly diverting in that case. But I always think of like the great chess combats of the past. You know, you had Bobby Fischer against Boris Spassky. You had Gary Kasparov taking on the supercomputer Deep Blue. All these kind of meetings of mind. It's the World Chess Championships next Saturday in India. Viswanathan Anand taking on Magnus Carlsen, who's the sort of chess prodigy, 22-year-old.
Yeah.
Wunderkind, extraordinary. He's very unhappy because...
He's been a national icon in Monocle magazine.
Well, absolutely. We were quick on the uptake. He's still only 22, extraordinary thing, but he's ranked number one. He's taking on Anand. It's in Chennai. Magnus isn't happy. He's taking his own chef. He says, you know, this is not right. It'll be biased in favour of Anand. He thinks it should have been a neutral venue. You know, Paris wanted to stage it. The Indian press, though, do you know what their issue is with the prodigious Carson? They think he is using hypnotism to win his matches. This is an absolutely genuine thing.
I love this
because
there was obviously all the Cold War paranoia with Spassky and Fischer. Every time there's a sort of grandmaster showdown, it's always
exactly.
nuts.
New. So do you know what they do, Rob? They're so paranoid about it. His opponents have taken to wearing mirrored sunglasses so that he cannot distract them. And apparently what they suggest that he does is if you focus whilst playing chess incredibly intensely, and our listeners can't see this, but I'm imagining what that would be like.
Yeah.
On a single square of the board, that then if you continue it and it's intense enough, you can read your opponent's mind. You can distract him and his entire game, even a grandmaster, seasoned player, his game goes to absolute pieces.
I'm going to try that when I'm presenting, I'm going to try that for the rest of the week with Andrew, see if I concentrate on just stare at his microphone.
See
what happens.
See if my pawn will move without you touching it.
That is the definition of deep blue. Classic.
Okay. Yes, please.
My favourite album when I was a kid was Chester Musical, written by Benny from ABBA and Sir Tim Rice.
Why don't you watch the games next Saturday?
Yeah, and set it
soundtracked
to music.
Soundtracked by that.
Yeah, well, that'd be great. I don't know how to play it. I won't know what they're doing, but who cares?
You'll enjoy it. Well, and you'll be transfixed, literally.
A lot of people, it's better than explaining the offside rule, isn't it?
There you go.
Tom, that was a really great news round. It's brilliant, isn't it? News roundup these days, Andrew.
He's raised his game.
It's just the whole show was a news roundup. News look ahead. Anyway. Tom, thank you so much for joining us, as ever.
Oh, Tom, you knocked that out of the park.
It's been 2 weeks now since US government employees returned to work following a 16-day shutdown. Much of the blame has focused on the Republican Party because of their unwillingness to cooperate with Obama. Here's a brief reminder of the tension that marred the country's political system.
There's also a faction on the far right of the Republican Party who've convinced their leadership to threaten a government shutdown if they can't shut off the Affordable Care Act. Some are actually willing to plunge America into default if they can't defund the Affordable Care Act. Think about that. They'd actually plunge this country back into recession, all to deny the basic security of health care to millions of Americans.
Well, two of Washington's veteran Congress watchers think that this immense dysfunction within the US political system is linked to an extreme faction within the Republican Party. Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein believe that some members of the GOP have become insurgent outliers in American politics, which makes it nearly impossible for the political system to deal constructively with the country's challenges.
Since Barack Obama became president, they believe that these extremists have escalated their demands, using the entire government of the US as their bargaining tool. What problems could these extremists cause again in the future? And have we learnt anything from a 16-day government shutdown that could prevent similar events from occurring? Well, joining us now to discuss this further is Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Happy to be with you again.
So this is a deep-seated problem we've got here. What's the main problem? It seems that the Republican Party, it's part of their DNA that they just hate to compromise.
The Tea Party, part of the Republican Party, is strikingly clear on that, and they really are in quite a contrast with other Republicans who understand the American system is predicated upon compromise. We're not a parliamentary system. We don't have governments that are built on majorities in the legislature and can put their program into place. It's much more difficult and complicated here and really requires a willingness of those from different kind of districts and states and of different parties to at some point be willing to compromise. But the Republican Party is now being dominated by a populist insurgency that has no interest in that.
Thomas, I was just going to say, you're now saying though that there is a group of outliers, people who are within the Republican Party, but really have kind of broken away from the central kind of tenets of what that party used to represent. Who leads those people? Could you give us an example of somebody, a character from that part of the party that you feel, you know, really kind of sums up all that's gone wrong with the system?
Well, there's one good choice for that figure, and that's Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. He came out of nowhere in the 2012 election, surprisingly defeated a well-known Republican to win the nomination for the Senate, and then easily won the general election. He's come to Washington and, frankly, done more to alienate his colleagues than any other member of Congress I can remember in some time. He's the one who insisted on tying Obamacare, as it's called, the Affordable Care Act, tying the defunding or delay or repeal of that to financing all of government activities. So he tried to take hostage the entire government to achieve an end that, frankly, means repealing a law that was duly enacted and doing it in a shortcut instead of winning elections in the White House and in the Congress and doing what's required to pass a subsequent law to change it or repeal it. He figures it's better to take hostages, the government operations, the threat of public default. So that really epitomizes what this group of Republicans has brought to the mix. But it's important to understand that they were welcomed with open arms by the Republican Party establishment. That establishment had been turning rightward for decades already. They had lived through some pretty radical times themselves, but they saw this as their route to power. They did win the House majority in 2010, but since then they've been regretting their association with the Tea Party and would love to figure out a way to push them into the background.
And Thomas, it seems that obviously the two parties have got further and further apart, not just looking at the Tea Party element of Republicanism. How can they come back from this? Because it seems that anyone that's a moderate is basically being called a sissy now. It seems that it's only strong-arm tactics on one side of the political divide that get any headlines and that make a splash.
But be clear, the Democratic Party has moderates. They are much more a pragmatic party now. Ever since Bill Clinton won the presidency in 1992, the Democrats have contained their more extreme ideologues very effectively, and they're always open to compromise. The difficulty now lies with the fact that our partisan polarization is asymmetric. It's the Republicans who one make ideological demands based not on facts or evidence, but on values and beliefs, and then employ tactics that really cut against the grain of American constitutional government. That's the fix we're in right now. It's affecting one party much more than the other, and until the Republican Party feels sufficiently threatened to give voice to its more pragmatic members, until the business community stops catering to those who would shut the government down or throw the country into default, until they start playing hardball with Republican extremists, we're probably not going to see change, at least not in the short term.
Thomas, I guess that one of the key things about this is, you know, electability looking forwards. You know, so it's great if you can play your own constituency and you know that by being a firebrand like this, you will continue to kind of keep hold of your seat, as it were. But for the party nationally, it must be kind of a worrying time. They must feel, actually, some of these kind of firebrands are going to destroy the game for the rest of us.
Very much so. House Republicans overwhelmingly represent safe seats. They live in echo chambers back home, and frankly, they have a mission. They don't care that much about the Republican Party nationally, but it's also the case that activists who are more likely to participate in primary elections, not just for Congress, but for the presidency, are egging on the Republicans to be radical in their ambitions and their methods. I mean, take Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who was instrumental in helping put together a bipartisan coalition, weighted toward the Democrats, but nonetheless, with significant Republican support to pass an immigration bill. Since that happened, given his presidential ambitions and fear of the politics of the Republican presidential nominating process, he actually strongly supported the Cruz strategy of threatening to and actually shutting down the government as a price for not defunding Obamacare. And now he's begun to even walk away from his handiwork in the Senate. So even Republicans with presidential ambitions fear that the energy in the party, those who are most active, the wealthiest of the contributors to so-called super PACs, are clearly on the right, and they fear to let distance grow between them.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Thomas. I've got one very quick last question for you. How on earth do you close the Grand Canyon? That's what I was wondering for the whole of this time. I guess it's one of those ones you have to just find the back entrance to it, right?
That's exactly. But I want you to know, government is all opened again, including all of our national parks. But alas, we could be going through it again on January 15th. So stay tuned.
We'll watch this space. That was Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Cookery books that leave a bad taste in the mouth? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
We're making porchetta sandwiches. It's a roast pork belly with some Italian seasonings. Just really simple, salt, pepper, fennel pollen. Simple, tasty.
I think food off a grill really just tastes exceptional. It's the sort of thing I like to eat, you know. Lamb, chicken, even octopus, squid always tastes good.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
You don't make business lunches here. You come usually alone or with somebody that you know very well, because it's homey style. You have to feel familiar with someone to eat in such a place.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Architecture is a powerful way to brand a place, but not without risk in a location rich in tradition and natural beauty. Monocle Films journeyed to the remote island of Fogo in Newfoundland to experience Todd Saunders' iconic artist studios and Travellers Inn.
Architecture is a tool, it's a language, and if done well, it can be a servant of place and people. And I think Todd does that. The studios are like little punctuation marks on the landscape that hold your attention. And a focus like that is a kind of a devotion, really, to the landscape.
Cultural resilience through architecture, now playing in the Films Menu on monocle.com.
Time for some music now. Here's California by French Horn Rebellion featuring Ghost Beach.
That was nice, Rob. Do you know who they are? Do I know who they are?
French Horn Rebellion.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with all of their work, but I did notice that our editor-in-chief put an amusing item on my desk a few days back.
Which was?
Horn cream. and I believe it is for maybe if you have a horn-rimmed spectacle.
Okay.
I don't think that was the spirit in which it was meant, though. What do you think?
I think that is very unlikely. And that was, anyway, as you just heard, California by French Horn Rebellion. Get the ointment, come round here. Rob's got some. Featuring Ghost Beach. In February next year, the world will turn its eyes to a small city on the edge of the Black Sea as the Winter Olympic Games begin in Sochi. The decision to host the event at the Russian seaside resort has caused huge controversy, described by critics of the Kremlin as one of the most corrupt projects in Russia's history.
As the city undergoes a dramatic transformation, two Dutchmen have been delving beneath the surface in an attempt to build up a clear picture of the complicated region. Photographer Rob Hornstra and writer-filmmaker Arnold van Bruggen came together in 2007 to create the Sochi Project.
The Dutch pair, who are advocates of slow journalism, have visited Sochi on a number of occasions, and we're now joined in the studio by one half of this duo, Arnold van Bruggen. Welcome to the show, Arnold.
Thank you.
Now, it's an epic project. It's writing, it's photography, it's a website which I had a look at, which is in Dutch, English, and Russian as well. So you're kind of hitting everybody who could be potentially interested. Tell us, how did this project begin, and how do you even begin to fund something like this, which is so epic and so long running? It's clearly not something that's going to be paying you a big salary.
No, unfortunately not. We started out by traveling to Abkhazia in 2006, and we still didn't know, have any clue about the Olympic Games in Sochi 2014. We didn't know about that. Only, I think, half a year later, in Guatemala, of all places, the IOC gathered and awarded the Olympic Games to Sochi, to Russia. And we were completely surprised because we just traveled throughout this region and we saw the poverty over there. We saw this tiny country, Abkhazia, which is actually bordering the Olympic Games. It's completely in ruin. It's like in a Cold War situation with Georgia now. You have Sochi itself, which is a summer capital. And then on the other side of the mountains, you have the North Caucasus, which is a really conflictuous, violent region and the poorest region of Russia. So we thought, hey, this is a region so full of contrast, and right in the middle of this subtropical, poor and violent region, they want to build the Olympic Winter Games. That is such a bizarre story, we have to follow up on this. At the other hand, it was also a big chance to make a stack of work about this region, because it's a very interesting region, a very historically interesting region. Really like to do work in this region, and the Olympic Games gave us some deadlines, so to say. So we wanted to do this five-year project, make our own stories, get complete liberty in making these stories and making these books we've made the past 5 years.
But just quickly before I pass over to Rob, tell me, how do you fund, who's funding you? Do you get a grant for this, or are you trying to sell photography to fund it?
Most parts are funded by donators and the buyers of our books. So we've made about 9 publications the last 5 years, bigger books, smaller books. So quite good, actually. But I think the largest part of our project is funded by around 700 donators. And they give us between 10 and 1,500 euros each year. With this money, we can fund our journeys, fund our books, our costs for translators and everything. And that works out brilliant, actually. Yeah.
And how easy was it when you were there to actually do your work, to shoot and to write and to interview the locals when a big project like this, especially in Russia, happens? Snooping around, or what might be considered snooping around, when what you're doing is asking a few kind of innocent questions, it's not looked upon very kindly, is it?
Well, I think the Caucasus is one of the most hospitable regions on Earth. So it's fantastic to travel through these regions and republics.
But maybe not from the locals, but maybe from the people that were banging the pegs in for the Olympics.
Yeah, that's also why we chose this sort of sequence in doing our work. We first went to Sochi and to Abkhazia, which is like the more innocent parts of our story. Uh-huh. And then later on in the project, we started visiting the North Caucasus. And that's like the really the south of Russia, and that's the real violent part of our story, where the insurgents are already battling Russia and Russian troops for more than 200 years. And there we really got into problem with the local governments and the security forces. And well, actually, it ended with us being denied a Russian visa. So we can't enter Russia anymore for the coming 5 years. Our exhibition in Moscow got canceled. That's really the result of working that long in the North Caucasus. And while working there, it was really like every time we went up in the mountains to visit like the insurgent places or the villages with a violent history, we got stopped by police and being taken to the police station when we were fined, or they tried to bribe us. And it was every time the same story. So yeah, it's really hard to work over there. But I think we've managed to do the work we wanted to make in the end.
And Arnold, you know, the attention you got is not just because obviously you're covering the building of this new Olympic city, but much of the reporting you've done is about the insurgency, is about, you know, the Moscow's relationship with the Islamic people who live in this region. And that's the kind of story they don't really want to be talked about too much. And they've had their Chechen war, they've had all of these issues going on. When you met people who are Muslims, who are maybe alienated from what's happening in Moscow, what was your reading of their relationship to what's happening in Sochi?
I think people in North Caucasus, they're not too interested in these games because their local reality is so completely different from what's happening on the other side of the mountains in Sochi. So I think they mainly care about living their own lives, stay as far away from the government and local security forces. They were amazed by the number of amount of money being invested in Sochi. If we told them that the games costed $50 billion, they were amazed by that, and they started counting. Okay, imagine if we share these dollars with all inhabitants of Russia, what would happen then? And then, of course, the other story, when we visited human rights activists, victims of the local security forces, they always said that when the games were awarded to Sochi, the human rights situation in the North Caucasus got really worse. Because all security forces and the local governments, they were allowed to do anything they wanted to suppress the violence and the terror coming from the North Caucasus.
And is this your reading of the situation there, that this Winter Olympic Games has been dropped into this fairly inappropriate area in order that it be a power base for Moscow in that ordinarily uncontrollable area? Is that what you think it's about?
Well, Sochi, of course, the funny thing is that Russians will look at you very weird, so to say, if you say you're doing the Sochi project and you go to the North Caucasus as well, because they think Sochi is not part of the Caucasus. They see Sochi as some sort of southern suburb of Moscow, while the North Caucasus is some far away tribal wild region. Well, it's really in the same region. So that got us into troubles with the government as well. Let's get back to your question.
Yeah, no, I wonder having done this project, whether you can give us a pretty simple answer, I guess, whether you think that the Winter Games have been bussed into this area in order that Russia can control that whole area. Because with Olympics come security, come investment and all the rest of it, there are all sorts of things you can mask by dropping in sporting event like this.
I don't think the games really are connected to that, because they already, I think when Putin took power in 1999, he immediately started the war with Chechnya to control this region. And he managed quite well compared to the 1990s. I think the Olympics are really meant as it has to be Putin's business card to the outside world, to the West, to the other world, to see this is modern Russia. This is how far we got in the past 15 years. In 2014, Putin will be in power for 15 years. And this is his business card to the world to show how modern and glamorous and rich Russia has become. And that's what we wanted to do in this project, to show the other side of this Russia. And it's so close by the other side of Russia.
Arnold, what for you is slow journalism?
I think the difference between us and normal journalists is that we stay there for weeks and weeks in a row, and we're not after the news, so to say. But actually what we do is more like knocking doors, you know. We just go from town to town, village to village, and we just knock doors and talk to normal people. And they, in the end, when we're lucky, they will tell us their family stories, and they will show us to other places, and they will show us other people who we can talk with. And so we travel through these regions, make our stories in a very, well, documentary way, actually. I think slow journalism is just another hip word for documentary making. I think we're just documentary makers.
I like it. You've got to tell us, I meant to ask you this straight away, actually, but what were you and Rob doing in, how come that region became attractive to you before you even knew that the Winter Olympics were going to be there in Sochi?
Yeah, I'm a historian, so I'm completely interested in this region where, before I traveled to the Balkans, actually, and the Caucasus and the Balkans are very comparable. It's like a place, a mountainous place where large empires or people collide, so to say, and these are always interesting places. The Caucasus is a place where Islam and Christianity collide and mix together. It's historically very interesting, and it's still interesting, of course, because there's so much going on. The 2008 war, of course, between Russia and Georgia, the insurgency in the North Caucasus, and these bizarre $50 billion games happening in February.
It's nuts. I'm Arnold van Bruggen. Thank you so much for talking us through the Sochi project.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
With nothing more than excellence in mind, Monocle scoured the globe for the most irresistible brands, retailers, artisans, and manufacturers. Our selection highlights the very best.
A decade after jeans manufacturer Dewhurst closed its base in Wales, entrepreneur David Hyatt decided to bring denim production back to the Tevi estuary. The town's heritage means its seasoned staff share over 200 years of industry experience.
Trader's secrets revealed in our Monocle briefing film, Spotlighting Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
On Tuesday, the skies above Britain will be ablaze with colour as Roman candles and Catherine wheels ignite in celebration of Guy Fawkes Night. The annual event commemorates the foiled gunpowder plot against King James I, who narrowly escaped death when a group of provincial English Catholics tried to assassinate the Protestant king and replace him with a Catholic head of state. Fireworks now act as a firm reminder of the cache of explosives planted beneath the House of Lords.
Fireworks have erupted to the delight of audiences in Europe ever since the Renaissance, but they're not simply a means of entertainment. Fireworks have helped foster advances in natural philosophy, chemistry, mathematics, and many other branches of the sciences.
To take a look at the history of fireworks, we're joined now by Simon Werrett, author of Fireworks, Pyrotechnic Arts and Sciences in European History, and lecturer in History and Philosophy of Science at University College London. So, Simon, thank you for joining us. Now, I'd always imagined that the early history of fireworks was completely a Chinese thing, that we'd kind of nicked it from them many years later. But in fact, it comes up in English history and in European history quite early on, doesn't it?
It does. It's only a couple of hundred years after the Chinese invented fireworks that you see them in Europe. And in the Middle Ages, a couple of hundred years is not that long. So things travel relatively quickly from China to Europe. The Chinese invented fireworks as a way to originally ward off demons, and soon by about the 12th century they're using them for festivals. And then in about 1380 you get the first records of them being used in Europe, both for war and for peace.
And that's knowledge that travelled along the Silk Route and brought them to Europe, or is it actually people were trading the fireworks all along the route, do you think?
Well, it's a great question, but unfortunately we don't really know. It's a bit of a blank spot in pyrotechnic history as to exactly how they got from China to Europe, possibly via the Mongols, who are fighting their way across Eurasia in that period. But we don't really know for sure.
I love the idea of pyrotechnic history. That's what I'm sort of like, the most dangerous branch of history, right? It's the type of history where you can literally get your fingers burned. But I wanted to know how you study pyrotechnic history, actually, Simon. Like whether there are depictions of fireworks in art, or whether they're written down, how you can tell that in 1380 there was a shift in the way that they were used.
Well, very fortunately, they did make very nice pictures of fireworks whenever they produced a big display in Europe, at least, in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And so we have that very impressive record of visual material to work with. There are also manuals on how to make fireworks that were, first of all, written down and then printed. So you can go and look at those. And then it's just a question of sifting through lots and lots of diaries and letters and books to try and find accounts of people going to fireworks displays and recording what they thought and felt when they saw these things.
And did they always think, ah?
They did. Oohs and ahs go back a long way.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
And that's probably the first words you learnt in Chinese, right? In Mandarin.
Well,
the first thing written down.
One thing that's very funny, well, it's not funny, but I think in the 16th century when Europeans first start to see fireworks, they're a rare event. You might only see one or two in your lifetime. And certainly the way that the courts, the elites, describe things, they like to say that people were afraid when they saw fireworks because they didn't necessarily understand that they weren't real fires in the sky, kind of meteors and thunder and lightning. And now, whether or not that's actually how people experience them, we don't know. But certainly in the early years, they're talked of as something that invokes fear as much as pleasure.
Now, I know that some of the early explorers, the people kind of traversing the world, also used fireworks to kind of scare the natives, as it were, as they came into port. Were ships a common source of fireworks then?
Well, I think it was very common from back in the times of people like Francis Drake to take fireworks on voyages of exploration or to make them on the voyage, because after all, you've got these huge long periods of time with nothing to do on a ship.
And plenty of explosives.
And plenty of explosives, exactly. So they were making fireworks and then they would use them. They saw them as something that could be used to demonstrate the power and civilization of Europeans to what they saw as a kind of backward people that they were encountering. And I think the way that they understood what they were doing is a bit like the elite back in Europe who saw the common folks as being afraid of fireworks. And they thought that people they were meeting in America and Africa and India would also be afraid. And again, whether or not they were is totally open. It's not at all clear that was the case, but that's what people thought the effect of fireworks would be.
And obviously in the UK, in England, I guess specifically, there's the idea that fireworks are always tied with bonfire nights, with Guy Fawkes, with the Catholic plot. So they're a cautionary tale still, aren't they? They've come back as having that sort of reason in the UK. What about elsewhere? Are they always used in a celebratory way nowadays?
Well, the thing that's often said is it's quite amusing that other countries celebrate their revolutions and we celebrate the fact that we didn't have a revolution.
Yes, exactly.
But they're used all around the world and, yes, absolutely in celebratory ways, most famously in the US and for the 4th of July, for Independence Day, for the 14th of July in France and so on and so forth. They're a very enduring and very widespread technology. There aren't many technologies that kind of last that long.
And they seem to have migrated to, in most countries, a kind of New Year's Eve celebration now. Even here in the UK, maybe 10, 15 years ago, that would never happen. Now you look up at the night sky on New Year's Eve and there's loads of people letting off fireworks. And I know that's the case in Germany and other countries as well. Has it been a traditional way of ushering in the new year for a long time?
It has been. That was one of the first things, I think, that fireworks were used for, going all the way back to medieval China. I know at the end of the last century, they weren't used, certainly in Britain, very much for New Year, but I think the millennium celebrations really started a trend of having big fireworks displays on New Year's Eve, and long may it continue.
I wonder what the economics... I'm so bad with money, Andrew. I can't even say the word. What I wonder about the economics of it. I always think of China as being the sort of hotbed of where they make fireworks. But where are the sort of key places where they're manufactured around the world? Who makes the money out of them?
Well, these days it's definitely China.
Yeah.
Pretty much all the fireworks that are made now are made in China. But there are also more specialist companies that do these big displays where the fireworks are handmade. So, for example, there is a company called Ruggieri in southern France that makes fireworks for a lot of the displays that you see on TV. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago that there were British manufacturers, people like Brock and Paynes, who are quite familiar from childhood. Yeah. But nowadays, it's mostly from China.
And have they got better, I wonder? Are they making them better, or was there a golden age of manufacturing them of a certain type of display, maybe?
Well, it's a little bit like fine art, like painting and sculpture, where it goes through different styles and different periods of history. So it's kind of hard to say which was the best period. Certainly in terms of things like colour, nowadays pyrotechnists can make much better, stronger colours than they could in the past. But even something like that is not that clear, because in the 16th and 17th century, for example, people distinguish lots of different types of red and yellow. Yeah. So they would say that their fireworks were multicolored, whereas when we look at them, we would say, well, it's just the color of fire.
There's damask and there's burgundy and there's etc.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And Simon, do your studies have a practical edge as well? Are you on November the 5th here in the UK kind of lighting many a firework?
Well, one of the things that I do want to do is to start doing practical experiments with fireworks.
Throwing firecrackers at your colleagues.
Well, I'll do that already. But looking at, for example, old recipes from, say, Elizabethan times and trying to reconstruct them to see what kind of effects people actually saw at those times or to understand how fireworks were made and the kinds of effects that they could produce.
And were you always a firework fan?
Well, I was always a science fan. And
that's what you'll say, Andrew. He's a pyromaniac.
Yeah. So I was always into science and also art. So I started out doing painting. And basically, most of my work has been about looking at how those two things are connected. And fireworks is a really great subject for thinking about that relationship. So that's how I got into fireworks. But I didn't kind of go around blowing things up. I may yet. But for now, it's really the kind of scientific and artistic side of it that always fascinated me.
And where are you going to be spending November the 5th? I mean, there are some famous, I mean, in the UK here, there are some famous, obviously, you know, bonfire nights. Where do you do yours? Do you run around the country?
Yes. Well, I'm kind of spoilt for choice because I've just got back to the UK from being abroad for a long time. Right. So I have to figure out the one of the many displays available. It would be great to go to Lewis, because Lewis is famous for its very spectacular fireworks. So that's the next place on my list to go.
Nice. I love that. We were just, before we switched the microphones on, we asked Jack, who's the engineer on this show, what his favourite type of firework was, and he said a little screamer. And I thought we should just keep the conversation on the track of fireworks. Simon Werritt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there we have it, Andrew.
I enjoyed that show. I'm not sure that I really love fireworks.
Do you not?
Well, I don't know.
Do you get a bit bored halfway through?
Yes.
Yeah. My favourite firework enjoyer is our head of PR and marketing, Emily Smith. We went to a Verbier one year together, and she was agog.
Was she?
She was fairly refreshed, but she was agog at the fireworks. I've never seen anyone more excited by a firework display than she was that year.
It's because people always pretend there's like some kind of like arc, like a play or something, but they're just really like loud bangs going off. There's not that much of a kind of a story to tell, is there?
There's not really that much of a story to
tell. And I'm always desperate to get back in the warm and have another drink.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it's quite good to have, that's where you need your mulled wine. You need to get out there. You need to get out there on bonfire night and you need to imbibe. And that sort of keeps you warm, but only for a certain amount of time. The best thing, yeah, you're right, exactly. But I like the way of not being able to tell stories through fireworks, like as if you're kind of going, hang on, I haven't got a bit of paper. Have you got a pen? No, I haven't got a pen. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll light 7 fireworks and then I'll tell you how I feel. Imagine if that was possible. It's all right.
I'd light off a Roman candle now, Rob.
Open the windows in here. That was edition 226 of the Monocle Weekly. We should thank Barbara Feeney, our producer, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be here again next week. I won't be here again next week.
I'm going to be here, though.
Are you?
I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, God. I'll phone my performance in like a leading actor in a sort of sitcom. That's what I'll do. We might not be the Dream Team again same time next week, but I think Andrew's going to be here, aren't you?
I'm definitely going to be here.
I'm going to be hanging out, but not necessarily at Midori House. So for me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.